everybody. Welcome to another episode of Courtside with Bielans and Tennis, part of the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. Here, as always, with my co-host and Hall of Famer, Steve Flink. The Sunshine Double is now complete. And I don't do this on every episode, Steve, but standing O to both Grigor Dimitrov and Danielle Collins right there, right? I mean, both. I don't think it was expected. I'll throw some things out there, but Grigor and Danielle, I mean, my gosh, heck of a run. And I know Grigor didn't win it, but still, amazing run by Grigor to me.
Yeah, well, he would tell you that in a way he did win it. I mean, he felt that way after the final. I can understand that because he's nearly out of there early. He's down a set in 5-2 in the tiebreaker. He could have been out of that tournament in the second, third round. And then he survives Hercosh. We'll talk about that later, I think. And then, but eventually, you know, goes right through Carlos in a brilliant display. And then Zverev in three hard fought sets before it all caught up to him in the final against Sinner. But he had accomplished so much by then to be in the finals, to be back in the top 10 now, that he had every right to regard it as a triumph rather than a disappointing losing final. So a great effort from him. It is almost comparable to Collins, but for her, obviously, biggest title of her career. And to beat Rybakina in straight sets, you know, in 5 and 3 in the final, and having played so well to get there, she lost a set early and then really went through the field cleanly from there. And it's interesting because, as we all know, she announced that she's going to retire at the end of the year. I think she wants to have a baby, and there's all those reasons. It seemed like good reasons for her to go. And I still think she will live by that. On the other hand, let's see what happens the rest of the year now. Even if she hardly wins matches the rest of the year, she will remember this time in Miami and be very appreciative of it, because she came into the tournament 53 and has really leapfrogged from there. So I think that she's got a lot to be proud of. She, you know, when she's right, she's an interesting player, David. When she's right, you know, she can do something like this. When things are a little bit off, then, you know, she can lose a lot of early on matches too. That's what makes her kind of intriguing, captivating player. You never quite know what's going to happen, but she will always give you full effort. She's a great competitor.
Yes. I mean, like she was unseeded, like you said, ranked 53 at the start of the tournament. Now she's going to be ranked 22nd in the world. It's the second unseeded woman to win the Miami Open, the lowest ranked woman to win it. She beats 5 seeds, including, like you said, Rybakina in the final. Again, very, very impressive. Grigor, what? In 2017, he wins Cincy in the ATP year-end finals. He's made the semis of 3 of the 4 slams. We all remember the Aussie Open semi against Rafa when he lost 7-5 in the fifth. That was a crazy good match. I mean, this tennis, though, at Grigor, for 32 years old, it's a reincarnation. You could just see the appearance. He's extremely fit. But the movement at 32, Steve, the movement at 32 is simply remarkable to me. He's moving around like he's 24 years old.
Yeah, I think he's playing better, by the way, than he did in 17. I mean, yes, he got to 3. That was a strange year in some ways. Roger and Rafa coming back, and they claimed all 4 of the slams. Novak was going through some elbow difficulties. He had an off year. There was sort of an opening in the game for somebody like him. He took full advantage and played tremendous tennis. But I honestly think his level is higher right now as he climbs into the bottom of the top 10. I think he's going to 9 in the world now. And Grigor, I just feel like the kind of tennis he's playing is even more imposing, you know, more powerful. He's able to dictate more. Forehand is better than it was then. The backhand's every bit as good as it was then. And the serve, I think, is better than it was then. So you could say maybe he's not quite as fast as he approaches 33 as he was back then, but he still moves beautifully and he's incredibly fit. So I think historically, he's had very good results, been on clay. So there's no reason that he can't have built some momentum here to do some good things in Monte Carlo and beyond. And then he's been a semifinalist at Wimbledon. 2014, he lost to Novak and almost went 5. He had set points to take it to a 5th. So we know what he can do on every surface. U.S. Open semifinals where he beat Roger and lost to Medvedev. So it's 19. So, you know, he's a great all-surface player who's now, I think, is going to make the most of the next 18 months to 2 years. The window is there for him to play great, really right up, I should say 2 years, because right up to 35, I think he can stay in this region.
Let's hope you're right, because he's awesome to watch. And he had a trifecta of match wins this past week, which was incredible. We'll start with Hurkacz in the round of 16. I mean, it was a third set tiebreaker, crazy type of deal where Hurkacz, it's 2-2 in the tiebreaker, I believe it was 2-2.
Yes.
Hurkacz has an easy ball. For all intents and purposes, Hurkacz was winning the point. It was a sitter, but he had to run up to the net. Hurkacz's foot hits the bottom of the net. Gives a huge break to Grigor with that point. Grigor winds up winning that tiebreaker and hence winning the match.
You know, he's an interesting guy, David. Hurkacz is so, he's so emotional. And he's so easygoing off the court. He seems like a teddy bear off the court. You listen to him talk, and he's obviously a exceedingly nice guy. On the court, he can let his emotions get the better of him. I think he did there. He knew he touched the net. I think he was more angry with himself than he was at the umpire. We'll never know. But you got to get on with it after that. You're still only 3-2 down, and he all lost at 7-3, but he was essentially gone after that point. And that's a
And
shame.
Grigor was tired, Steve. That helped. That whole pause like that helped him.
Yeah, it did. It did. It was a reprieve. It was a break. And also he could see that Hubie was imploding. So that only encouraged Grigor all the more. It's too bad because I've seen a lot of Hurkacz matches, close losses. He loses a lot of tough final set tie breaks or 7-5 in the third. So many close matches. And I often think the five setter to Medvedev in Australia, I often think that the difference is not, it's not his tennis, it's what's inside his ears. I don't mean, and that's true of so many players. I don't mean to pick on him for that, but I feel like, that's what's held him back from maybe finding a place in the bottom of the top five in the world instead of the bottom of the top 10. And it's too bad. And this was another one of those instances, and you could see he was just furious, and it was bad luck. But it's not like it suddenly put you down match points. There was time to recover, but he didn't.
And then the quarterfinal Grigor had with Carlos Alcaraz. I mean, we were looking forward to seeing that. And my God, did he put a beating on Carlos? And Carlos admitted it. I mean, first set races up 3-0, had a couple break points to go 4-0. He didn't get it. But he winds up winning the first set 6-2. The second set, he's up 4-1. He had a break point up to go 5-1. Then it got a little interesting. A
Well,
little interesting
you're
because
right.
Carlos.
It got interesting because he got a little tight there, David. I think he was disappointed by missing. There was a second serve return that he missed off the forehand when he had the break point for 5-1. And then Carlos managed to get the hold from there. And the next game was the only time Grigor lost his serve in the whole match was in the next game. It was kind of a feeble game. Carlos serves a good game. It's 4-all. And you and I were texting at the time, and I think we both thought, oh boy, this match could be turning irreversibly in the direction of Alcaraz. But all credit to, this is where I admired Grigor the most, because things were just flowing so freely for him up until 6-2, 4-1. Everything going his way, he was in the zone, he could do no wrong. But when you lose those three games, and when you almost had it wrapped up, with you seal the break point for 5-1, it's over, and suddenly it's 4-all. He served a really good game at 4-all, including an excellent kick serve on the sideline, got him to 40-15 in the ad court, and then an ace at 40-30 down the tee. Clutch game, and then broke him in the final game. The fact that he regrouped so well after the three-game lapse, just that just showed us too that not only physically is he at an all-time high, but mentally he's more stable and able to recover. You know, he like anybody else, he can choke here and there, but boy, did he get on with it from 4-all.
I think, Steve, a person like Grigor, who has had a ton of experience, that helped him in that situation. I think if it was a younger player who maybe not have had the amount of experience that Grigor has, they may not have been able to hold when you're up 4-1, break point 5-1. Now all of a sudden it's 4-4 and things are turning. I think experience helped Grigor immensely in that situation.
Well, it did. Yeah, it did. But absolutely. But Carlos was puffing his chest. You could feel like Carlos had that sense of, that he was going to be able to get out of this precarious position he was in. I felt like it was the only time he looked confident, and he was quickly deflated again, thanks to Grigor's professionalism and discipline. So Yeah, it was a yeah, that was I don't think I've seen him play a better complete match than he did there. And Carlos, the comment he made afterwards, he felt like a 13-year-old, and that was a tremendous compliment to Grigor, because basically he was saying he took me to school and I didn't have any answers. I couldn't figure anything out there. I didn't know what he was going to do, and I didn't know how to stop it. So that's you can't get a bigger compliment than that, because I've heard Carlos after other losses where he's been very self-critical and even compared this to the loss he had against Grigor, a three-setter last fall. And he said he felt like he played much better in this match than he did in the three-set loss. So that again tells you how well that Grigor played.
And then the semi, right? I'm sorry, Sasha Zverev. Zverev 7-1 head to head, Steve. It's been really one-sided, but you didn't know. I mean, was Grigor gonna keep that hot, insane level on to continue in this match? This one got dicey as well. First set on serve until Grigor breaks. Zverev at 5-4 to win the set.
Yeah, and that was a dangerous moment from Zverev's standpoint, because he had 30 love in that game, and then he made a one great acrobatic backhand volley winner from Grigor, got him back in the game. But then three pretty bad errors from Grigor that after that, I mean from Sasha after that,
Sasha.
and then including the very kind of wobbly forehand down the line that went wide on set point down. He had to have been really disappointed, because most of his holds had been pretty comfortable, and now here he is looking like he's going to at least get to a tiebreak. That hurt him, but he did battle back to take the second in a tiebreak before Grigor beat him in three.
The
Grigor didn't
second
lose.
set, Steve, was interesting because Grigor almost won that in two. I mean, Zverev was down 4-5, love 30
Yes,
in
love
that
30.
second set. He won 4 points in a row to hold.
Yeah.
For 5-5. And then I noticed Zverev's backhand down the line late in that set started to really work dividends for Zverev to win some big points. Zverev wins that tiebreaker 7-4, and now you're like, is Grigor gonna have enough in the tank to win that third set? And sure enough, he
Oh, he
did.
did. Yeah, he had plenty in the tank, and he also just continued to serve with great precision and consistency. And he never got broken in the three sets. The one set he loses is a breaker, so I think that also made him feel, gave him a lot of inner security, feeling like, okay, I'm still serving well, I'm still playing well. He squeezed out a tiebreak. I didn't quite get him at 4-5, love 30, when I might have been able to end it, but there was no sense, no lack of resolve
He
and
was
physical.
down a break point at 1-2 in that third set,
Yeah.
too. That would have been tough if he got
that,
broken.
that could have yeah, that could have killed him, but it didn't. No, he was very poised on the break point, and that was one of the few opportunities that Sasha had the whole match on Grigor's serve. And then finally it was Grigor who got the break, and then he served a love game closing it out, came in, served and volleyed a few times, played a terrific last game. So yeah, that was a wonderful follow-up to what he'd done against Carlos.
The 3-3 break point was interesting. I mean, Grigor was totally in control of the point. Now, he would have hit a volley no matter if the ball that Zverev hit the top of the net or not. But Zverev did hit the top of the net, and Grigor had to adjust a little bit, and he hits a winning volley falling down. It looked pretty cool in the highlights. But even if it didn't hit the tape, Grigor was covering that shot.
Well, yeah,
He
but it
played
was
a beast.
beautifully done on the dive there to put the forehand volley away, and yeah, it was a good game that he played there, very timely, and then no hesitation the way he closed it out from there. So look, I mean, it was a much tougher match than Carlos, but it was a really hard-earned victory, and that
And he
got
had a
him in.
day off, Steve. He had a day off for the fun.
Yeah.
I thought like the day off could help him. We all were thinking, I mean, Sinner, I mean, God, going into that match, he was what, 21-1? He's now 22-1, 42-3 since the US Open. I mean,
Yeah.
I was thinking, all right, Sinner's he's playing unbelievable, but at least Grigor has a day off. Because he had played the semi on Friday. So he didn't do anything on Saturday. Sure enough, he just ran into a buzzsaw yesterday,
Yeah,
Steve.
no, that time factor was insignificant as it turned out, because you lose 3-1. I mean, stamina never came into play there. He had one opening early on, David, and that's when he'd actually served a couple of love games at the beginning. Grigor held at love twice, and now he's at 2-1 with a break point for 3-1. And he got back a 128 mile an hour serve down the tee for a great serve from first serve from Jannik. And he was in pretty good shape in the point, Grigor was, and so he went for an inside-out forehand. It wasn't really going to be a winner, but it might have set up the next shot to win the point, and he missed it wide by probably 2 inches. And that was literally the only – he never had another opportunity like that. And so 11 out of 13 games from there for Sinner, and he just got better and better, and his passing shots were just scintillating. And one forehand down the line pass, another back and down the line pass, lifted out of your dreams. And he served better and better. And again, it was another one of those typically Sinner. I'm mentioning a couple of golden moments, but by and large, it was just bread and butter, very simple formula. He doesn't try to overplay anything. It gives you nothing. And I felt like, yeah, I mean, Sinner the last two rounds. In the meantime, he's come off a 1-2 win over Medvedev. Nobody does that to Medvedev. I mean, he's lost two matches like that in his career. One of them was a 3-love loss to Rafa in the finals of Canada back in 19 when he had his first great summer, Medvedev. It just doesn't happen to him like that. I've never seen him look so dismayed coming off a loss. As he walked to the net, he almost felt humiliated. And, you know, he had a few breakpoint opportunities here and there. He wasn't able to break Yannick. He had breakpoints early in both first and second sets, but he was just thoroughly outplayed. He tried to actually bring some of the same offense that we saw from him in Australia when a lot of us thought that was because he was fatigued after 3-5 setters and felt like he had to play that way. And it almost got him the victory because Medvedev was up 2-11 in that Australian Open final, but he couldn't close it. This time, he started to press a bit. It didn't work as well because I felt like Sinner defended better off of Daniel's biggest shots. And Daniel then started to miss. Daniel started to press. It wasn't an avalanche of errors, but those that he made were very costly. And then he couldn't extract any from Yannick. That was fascinating because there's 5 in a row for Sinner against Medvedev. But the previous 4 were all, there were a couple last fall, you know, a 6-6 final, and then another match, tough 3 sets. Then the year-end championships was also 3 sets, and finally the 5-setter in Australia. So you never, nobody was anticipating. I remember even listening to Jim Courier on the commentary early on in the first set, thinking that, oh no, one break's not going to be enough in a match like this. And you could tell he was expecting something close. We all were. And yet he went out and just beat the daylights out of Medvedev. And he's in a tough spot now, David. We talked about this after Indian Wells when Carlos beat Medvedev. I mean, here's Medvedev getting to the latter stages of all these tournaments, getting to all these finals. Hasn't won a tournament since Rome last year. Because the likes of Alcaraz and Sinner are always getting in his way, and obviously Novak did in the U.S. Open final. So his consistency is commendable. But I'm sure he's saying to himself right now, what am I going to do against these two young guys, Sinner and Alcaraz? That's what he's particularly worried about now. How am I going to beat them? And obviously, he owned Sinner for a long time until it turned last fall. And now it looks like it might be permanent. And then with Carlos, yes, he beat him at the U.S. Open in a great performance in the semis. But otherwise, Carlos beat him in the year-end championships, beat him in Indian Wells. It looks like he still has his number. So I must say, I have a lot of sympathy for Medvedev, who's a hardworking professional and completely dedicated to his craft and a Grand Slam champion, having won the 21 U.S. Open. But right now, things are not looking that positive for him in terms of what he can do against his chief rivals.
The chief rivals, right. I mean, Sinner, my calculations are correct. He lost 7 games in the semis and final, and that's the likes of Medvedev and Dimitrov. I mean, that's impressive as all get out. I want to mention a couple other moments in the tournament that were really entertaining, not just for me, but for all tennis fans. The quarterfinal match between Maria Sakkari and Lina Rybakina. Rybakina wins the first set, has 2 match points in the second set. Maria saves them, right? Wins the second set in a tiebreaker. Maria then saves 2 more match points at 3-5 in the third, Steve. Holds that game to go 4-5. What does Rybakina do? She shows that she has the best first serve in the game and comes up. She loses the first point, go love 15, then 4 huge first serves in a row to take the match.
Yeah, including a cut 2 or 3 aces in there. That was a wonderful way to close out the match. That was probably the best women's match of the tournament. But you see that match and also the match that she played Rybakina against Vika Azarenka, which was a weird match. He won the first, Rybakina won the first, dropped the second, 6-love, and won 7-6 in the third. These matches, you know, all of these hard-fought contests, I think, caught up to her a bit when she played Danielle Collins in the final. We'll never know how much, but she's had that problem most of the year. She's had fantastic results, and she's been enormously consistent, but a lot of three setters. And sometimes you have too many in one tournament, it's gonna really prevent you from, and I thought in a way she wasn't quite fresh enough in the final. We'll never know, because Collins saved 10 out of 11 break points. She was outstanding under pressure on her serve on the big break points when she had to be. And that included 3-all in both sets. First set 3-all, which could have turned that set that eventually went to Collins 7-5. Long, long game, a bunch of break points against Collins. She saves them. 3-all second set, very similar. If Rybakina can break there, maybe it goes her way. Instead, she doesn't break and she gets broken herself in the next game. And Collins eventually serves it out after having to face more break points in the last game. So it really was a question of the big points. There wasn't that much that separated them. 5-3 looks fairly straightforward. It wasn't quite as comfortable as the score line, but Collins deserved it because she just kept coming at her. She kept forcing the issue. And in the end, the aggression paid off.
And I do want to highlight one other player because she had two amazing wins. Alexandrova, she beats Pegula 6-4 in the third, and the one before that, the match before that, she smacked Iga Swiatek 6-4, 6-2. I mean, to get back-to-back wins against Swiatek and Pegula, I mean, there's something to be said for doing that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Pegula never had a chance. I mean, excuse me, Iga never had a chance. Pegula did. She got back into the third set, went up 4-3 on serve. But Alexandrova, sometimes it's like poor Pegula. She didn't have any say in the conversation the last three games. There wasn't really much that she did wrong. This girl just picked her apart and won those last three games. And it was very impressive. And I thought she was maybe going to have a pretty decent chance against Collins. But it didn't happen. It didn't happen. You know, Danielle was in such good form by then that she knocked her off in straight. And coming into that match, I thought it was kind of a coin flip whether Alexandrova or Collins would win. And good effort.
One other note off the court that has been noteworthy. Novak Djokovic and Goran Ivanisevic are no longer working together. You know, it's April Fool's, so no one would believe me when I'd say you were the new coach for Novak Djokovic, but we know that's not the case. We are recording this on April 1st, which is April Fool's Day. But no, obviously, interesting decision. I mean, Novak, I mean, when you say Novak struggled, it's all relative, right? I mean, his results are so amazing. When we say his struggle, that's amazing results for 99% of the other players. It'll be interesting to see his next move with his team.
Yeah, you know, I'm still a little confused. He talked about them, how they started in 18, and I think maybe he talked to him in 18, but Goran was not really fully aboard until 19. But what a run from 19 through 23, and that included a couple of three slam seasons in 21 and 23. And I mean, last year one of his very best seasons. And yes, you're right. So Novak, all he's played this year was Australia and Indian Wells, and had the semi in Australia and lost to Sinner, and then obviously the very disappointing loss in Indian Wells. So it's hard to know. I think maybe it just Djokovic came away from Indian Wells very disappointed because he had put so much time in trying to prepare for it, got to California so early. I think maybe in his mind was expecting to make a real bid to win it, and it didn't happen. So nobody can, it's not that clear from Djokovic's message or from any of the reports that have come out is exactly what the reason was. But sometimes, you know, these after a period of years of someone like Novak has done this, you know, he had some years with Becker, you want to hear a different voice. At least that's what I think he feels. Plus, he did admit in his message that they always got along great off the court. They didn't always get along so well on. There were times he really vented at Goran during matches. And I don't know whether part of that was he felt like Goran had not given him the right advice and therefore he was playing you. It wasn't that clear, but there would be some bickering and they'd go at each other a little bit and you'd see the expression on Goran's face. So I think there were times where there were honest disagreements about how to proceed with the matches. But off the court, I think they were pretty good buddies. I certainly hope that the personal friendship lingers, I mean, that it endures.
Oh, well said. Yeah, I hope so too. And again, it will be interesting to see Novak's next move. There's some rumors going on out there who he might select next, but nothing formal as of this recording. So with that,
You
the
know, the thing
Sunshine
about
Devil is
quick
okay.
comment on that, he had that hitting partner, and I don't know the guy's name, but if you watched a lot of those matches the last few years, the hitting partner would often seemingly be saying more to Novak than even Goran was when they were allowed to coach, when he was down that end of the court. And the hitting partner seemed to be really quite vocal with him and quite aggressive in a good way about telling what he thought he should do. So I'm wondering whether this guy might step in a larger way and be at least the interim coach, because it appeared to me that he was capable of doing it.
Yeah, we'll see. It'll definitely be interesting news when it's formally announced. With that being said, the Sunshine Double is now done. It's such a great time for tennis fans, especially in the US, to watch those two events. We now move on to the clay season. I feel like the clay season is pretty long. We have some tournaments in the US right now on the WTA side. It's Charleston, and on the men's side, you got the US men's clay courts down in Houston. There's some other tournaments going around too. But it's a good few weeks in the States with the Sunshine Double. Overall, I give it an A, both those tournaments. It was good for the players, it was good for the fans, it was good for the people in attendance and the viewers who were watching on TV. Overall, I give it an A, Steve.
Yeah, I would too. I would too. And then, of course, the nice part of it is, okay, there's just a brief little stretch here, and then suddenly next week we're going to be at it in Monte Carlo. And I feel like that's going to be really fascinating to see whether Nadal is actually ready to play. And if he is, how well does he do? Can he get two, three, four matches in? Does he get injured again? We just don't know. Djokovic with a chance for a revival here. Sinner trying to keep his great hardcourt form going onto the clay. And we know how much Carlos loves the clay. So I think he'll be delighted to be back out there on the dirt. So a lot to look forward to in that first Masters 1000 of Monte Carlo.
Agreed. Thanks for your time tonight, Steve.
Thank you, David.